Welcome to CEUcast, the convenient way for mental health professionals to improve their practice and earn continuing education online. Here's your host, Micah Perkins.
Welcome to CEUcast, where Oklahoma mental health professionals can listen, learn, and earn continuing education just for listening to the show. What if you're a mental health professional from another state? You may still be able to earn continuing education. Just go to CEUcast.com for details. CEUcast, a project of Edmond Counseling and Professional Development.
But ACT does it in a very different way. ACT is unique in that it focuses less so on the symptoms and more so on the mindful action towards creating a meaningful life.
On today's CEUcast, Jeff Jones, our featured presenter, will discuss the basic components of acceptance and commitment therapy. But first, in our Provider Spotlight segment, Kayla Jones will share with us what's new at the HALO Project in Edmond, Oklahoma.
On today's Provider Spotlight, I have Kayla Jones. Kayla is in private practice in Edmond, and she also does work with the HALO Project. Hey, Kayla.
Hi, Micah. How are you?
I'm doing well. Kayla, tell us about the HALO Project.
So the HALO Project is a nonprofit organization based out of Oklahoma City that provides lots of different types of resources and therapeutic groups for foster and adoptive children. HALO actually stands for Healing Attachment Loving Outreach, and it started as a 10-week intensive outpatient intervention designed actually to meet unique and diverse needs of children in foster care, children that have been adopted, or children that have been exposed to specifically relational trauma. It relies heavily on what's called trust-based relational intervention, which is a model created by Dr. Karen Purvis and Dr. David Cross from the Karen Purvis Institute of Child Development from Texas Christian University in Fort Worth. This is the target population for our 10-week intervention, and we focus on six families for 10 weeks, ranging from ages 3 to 7 or 8 to 12. We also do teens, but the program looks a little bit different for teens.
So this is a group program where people come in, and it's a closed group. So they come in and meet for, I think you said 10 weeks. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. They get 3 hours of therapeutic services. So 2 hours in group, one night a week, and 1 hour of family or individual therapy.
Oh, I see. So for that 10-week period, they come in, they do 2 hours of group each week, which is that on one evening?
Yes, but it ranges on whatever evening it is. Typically, our group nights are between Monday and Thursday night.
Okay. And so then come in and do a group. So the kids are in one group, and then the adoptive or foster parents, are they in a different group or a parent group?
Yeah, so we have parents in one room, kids in another room, and we provide one-on-one ratio of adults per child in the kids group. So we utilize volunteers for the 10 weeks. Each kid is assigned a buddy, an adult buddy, that sticks with them through the whole 10 weeks. One, to help foster that building of connection and attachment. And then they have one-on-one attention through the whole 10 weeks, along with a child therapist that comes in and kind of leads the child therapy group. We have another therapist that leads the parent education class at the same time.
So what are some of the things that the children's group focuses on?
Great question. So they focus on many different aspects of the TBRI principles and curriculum. So in group, we do a lot of fun play therapy activities that include building connection, so nurturing games, TheraPlay games. We also do specific games on correcting principles, so learning how to do the redo, asking for compromises, or responding to choices, and things like that. And so at the same time, ideally, the parents are learning these things in the education class while the kids are practicing these skills actively through the kids' therapy group.
And so doing these groups and then, as you said a minute ago, having the family counseling session 1 hour a week to then be able to talk about the parents and the child, talk about specifically how the week's been going and how they're applying these things at home.
Yes, and then problem solving.
The buddies that you talked about in the children's group, those are volunteers?
Yes, sir. We have a range of different types of volunteers, males and females alike. We require a background check and a buddy to be 18 years or older. And then they, of course, are committed to the 10 weeks. So we are gaining volunteers just through word of mouth. We have a lot of veteran volunteers that come and repeat rounds with us. And just, again, we're trying to spread the word about gaining more and more volunteers because we have more and more groups going on at the same time.
So this would be a great experience for somebody who's maybe a student in a psychology graduate program or even undergrad if it's 18 or above, or just has a passion for working with kids to come and be a volunteer.
Literally, anybody that has a passion working with kids. We have had a lot of volunteers that want to become foster parents and just wanting to a little bit of training or exposure. So it's just we have had a wide range of different types of volunteers for sure.
Do you ever have children or parents that want to go through the group again, or after they go through the 10 weeks, they graduate and they're done? How does that work after the 10 weeks?
It varies on the need of the family. Some families graduate and have gotten all their needs met after the 10 weeks. Typically, one family can go through the round one time, and so if they have multiple kids, they will just continue seeing that therapist, the HALO therapist, to continue utilizing the skills, building the skills after the 10 weeks on an individual or family therapy basis.
So if a family is going through family counseling or a child is getting counseling maybe before going to HALO, will they be able to continue to meet with that counselor while they're going through the HALO program, or I'm just thinking because of like billing, you know, if it's like Medicaid or something like that, do they have to take a pause from seeing their primary therapist while they're in the HALO program? How does that work?
Yes. So if it's a referral, typically there's a couple different options, but typically we ask for the families to pause with another counselor outside of the HALO project or someone who is not a TBRI practitioner. If their counselor is currently a TBRI practitioner already, then we will attempt to work with them and coordinate and collaborate with the team lead or the therapist that is leading the education class. But oftentimes they'll pause their counseling, do the 10 weeks, and then either they have an option to stay with the lead therapist at the HALO project, they graduate, or they can go back to their original counselor.
And if a counselor wants to learn more about TBRI, are there things that the HALO project is doing to help train counselors interested in that approach?
Yes, thank you for asking that. Yes, there's a couple other things that I wanted to mention that HALO is doing. So something that HALO started last year was what's called the OTCC, which is the Oklahoma TBRI Collaborative for Children. And so it's partnering organizations to help build TBRI knowledge in the community. So we're pairing up with other levels of care, including the justice system, DHS, public education, and things like that. And so we are opening and offering one-day training throughout the year for therapists, people in the justice system, people in DHS, people in adoptive organizations, and people that work in the education system to come and get a glimpse of TBRI and what that looks like in their level of care. And then for anybody that is a clinician looking to get more trained, there are other opportunities online where they can research different videos. There's even some books that they can read. And then there's a one-week-long practitioner training that is hosted by Texas Christian University and the Karen Purvis Institute on Child Development a couple times a year. And so they're taking applications pretty much all the time for the next round of the week-long training. And those are held around the country. So there's some in Fort Worth. There's some in Seattle. There's some in lots of different places.
Oh, great. So if a counselor wanted to either refer a family or give family information of the HALO Project, or if they wanted training in TBRI themselves, what would be a good place for them to go to get that information?
Yes. Well, HALO is actually in the middle of revamping their website, but the website is haloprojectokc.org.
haloprojectokc.org. So, Kayla, is there anything else that the HALO Project is doing that you'd like for people to know about?
Yes. So we are doing twice a year trauma-informed classroom training. So we're looking to collaborate again with the public school system and invite teachers to come in and get specific TBRI skills for the classroom. We are also opening up very soon different types of parent classes outside of the 10-week curriculum. And so anybody that's looking for parenting skills, new parents, old parents, anything like that, that just want more hands-on, then they can come and check that out. So keep an eye on the website for information about that. We're also always looking for different types of donations, volunteers, and things like that. So if you're interested in signing up to be a buddy or wanting to donate, volunteer, or find some way to give, we have lots of different ways to do that. We are starting a dream team opportunity where we're starting competitions for different teams to raise different types of materials and funds for HALO. And as a dream team, you can win prizes. And so keep an eye out for that. And so if that's something you're interested in, you can contact us as well. The office phone number we have is 405-753-4172 if you have any questions about any of the things that I mentioned today.
And the website is?
HALOProjectOKC.org.
HALOProjectOKC.org. Well, it sounds like you guys are doing a lot of great things there at the HALO Project. Thank you for coming on and telling us about it.
If you'd like to learn more about resources in our community, go to our free searchable database at myresourcelist.com. If your practice or agency isn't listed, click the Add a Resource button. It only takes a couple of minutes to add your information. You are now entering the CE Zone. This is the part of the program that will be on the quiz if you decide to get continuing education for this show.
Our feature presenter is Jeff Jones, LPC, LADC. Jeff is one of the counselors here at Edmond Counseling and Professional Development. He also is a counselor at the University of Central Oklahoma and works with the students there in the Student Counseling Center. Jeff got his undergraduate and master's degree from the University of Central Oklahoma. He also has experience working in community mental health. He has training in dialectical behavior therapy, motivational interviewing, and mindfulness-based treatments. Jeff is our resident guru on acceptance commitment therapy. So, Jeff, tell us more about acceptance commitment therapy.
Please listen carefully.
Acceptance and commitment therapy, or ACT as it's commonly referred to, is a therapy that was born out of the late 70s. It comes from the school of behaviorism and is considered a third wave therapy. ACT, again, acceptance and commitment, basically focuses on creating distance from our thoughts and feelings, which goes into a whole concept of mindfulness, and ACT is certainly a mindfulness-based behavioral therapy. By the end of today, I hope to explain more about what that means. But ACT could be thought of as a wide range of techniques and exercises focused on creating a rich and meaningful life. Now, most therapies would say that that was the goal for their clients and the people they work with, but ACT does it in a very different way. ACT is unique in that it focuses less so on the symptoms and more so on the mindful action towards creating a meaningful life. So as we talk about ACT today, what I hope to really emphasize is that ACT is unique in that it builds acceptance around the things that are inherent about pursuing a meaningful life, the challenges, the barriers, things related to mental health, trauma, some of the things that ACT is being used to focus on today. So while encountering those things, how can we pursue what we consider to be meaningful in our life?
Whenever you're meeting with a client, how do you present that paradigm shift? Because a lot of clients would come in and say, I have depression, I want to be less depressed, or I have anxiety, I don't want to have anxiety. How do you help them shift to, we're going to focus less on symptoms and focus more on you having a meaningful life?
That's a great question. And usually one of the first and most interesting parts of the ACT experience working with clients, as most clients would, as most humans would, come in with the goal of eliminating the bad parts of our experience, the bad parts that come with simply being human. So in the course of introducing ACT to clients, we first want to address that part of their agenda, what we call confronting the agenda. And that's something we'll elaborate further when we talk about the ACT model and what it looks like in session. But we talk about shifting our focus away from eliminating this part of their experience that seems to create such a barrier to living what the client may consider a meaningful life or a quality life, and shifting their focus on how do we live that life despite those discomforts, in the wake of those discomforts, while making contact with those discomforts, as a way of building acceptance that these things can be there, these experiences can be there, these hardships can be there, and I can still pursue what's meaningful. So I present often to clients that we are going to work on building acceptance of our discomfort. Now, many times, clients might look at me and shudder a bit because they, like most clinicians, they want to bring comfort and peace to their clients that are coming in. And asking a client to accept their discomfort may sound a bit taxing or stressful. But strangely, ACT has shown if we shift away from symptom elimination and focus more on values, which we're going to elaborate more on today, symptom reduction or symptom elimination happens as a side effect. So we know that that focus is actually what makes ACT so unique. And of course, being a mindfulness-based therapy, mindfulness is all about that shift in our perspective. And we'll certainly explain that further today.
So being a side effect, that's really interesting. So instead of really hitting the depression specifically and straightforward, it's we're going to work on creating a meaningful life. And as a side effect, you're going to experience less depression. As you accept that you're a person who has depression, you're going to experience less depression.
That's absolutely right. And kind of how ACT, just the term ACT, as it's referred to, acceptance and commitment, accepting the things that come up in life, accepting the things that are inherent in pursuit of things that are meaningful or valuable. And we'll discern later about the difference between goals and values. But pursuing those things, again, with full acceptance, opens us up to doing what's next or doing what matters most, and then committing to it. That second part of the model, commitment being probably the most important, that it takes acceptance of all these challenges that are inherent with what I consider to be a valuable life, and then actively choosing to go the direction of those things, even if I experience discomfort, even if I experience challenge, even if I experience even heartache or stress or any kind of pain, because the idea is that arriving in those places or acting inside those values is actually what gives life meaning, not trying to eliminate the things that are challenging or difficult.
And as you talk about this, one of the quotes that comes to mind for me is that one by Carl Rogers, which I'm probably not getting the quote exactly right, but something to the effect of, it's only whenever I accept who I am that then I can change. And so it's very similar, only till I accept how life is that life can change.
And I like to refer to acceptance as something that sort of arrives or intervenes as a state of mind. When acceptance arrives, it's sort of a limbering up, a readiness or a willingness to go in the direction of what's next. If you've ever experienced sitting in traffic and you're in a hurry to go somewhere and you're really upset or you're really feeling a lot of discomfort because you're sitting in traffic, and then you accept ultimately that being late or arriving whenever you do is not the worst thing to ever happen, that you are going to arrive, you are ultimately not in control of this traffic or anyone else who's on the road with you. It's a loosening up, and that's what acceptance is, sort of an active process. And I like to equate acceptance with willingness, using those terms sort of synonymously, a willingness to experience whatever happens in this present moment.
And you talked a minute ago about mindfulness playing a large role in ACT. So tell us more about that. How does mindfulness play a role?
Mindfulness is sort of a buzzword today. And as a mindfulness-based clinician, I'm always really excited to talk about what mindfulness is, because I think sometimes there's some misinformation about what mindfulness is. So mindfulness, particularly according to ACT, is a diffused, accepting, open contact with the present moment and private events that it contains as a conscious human being. So basically, it's the practice or the art of paying attention with intention. And as Jon Kabat-Zinn, one of the biggest names in mindfulness training, paying attention with intention as if your life depended on it. But mindfulness, to dispel one of the common myths, is not necessarily synonymous with meditation, although we'll talk about how meditation is one of the most common vehicles for arriving in mindfulness or achieving mindfulness. mindfulness can be defined in several different ways, but we think of mindfulness as simply paying attention. And that can be done at any capacity or in any setting. And it sounds a bit strange. We would often consider ourselves paying attention. But perhaps there are times when we are more mindless, we're going through the routines, or we're just less tuned in to what's going on around us. So mindfulness is about bringing our awareness to the present moment, participating in the moment as it's happening. But mindfulness sounds really nice and it sounds really easy. But what I like to encourage is that mindfulness is an active process. Mindfulness is actually, if you've ever sat down and maybe you've worked with a clinician, maybe you've sat in a yoga class or you've even attended one of our trainings on mindfulness, you know that when you sit down and you intentionally pay attention to your breath or your body or to a particular action, your mind has no opinion about you trying to achieve that state, and it's going to do whatever the mind does. And I like to consider that the playfulness of the mind, where the mind is likely to become distracted, lost in thought, lost in that feeling and sensation, where we will consider ourselves drifting away from the present moment. And then we will acknowledge that we're drifted or we're distracted, and then we have to bring ourselves back.
What percentage of the time would you say that people are lost in their thoughts, just kind of in their daily lives?
Well, that's a good question. I think that for most of us, we are, as humans, doing what we can to focus on the good. So we're showing up with our attention in the good, and we're oftentimes distracted or trying to turn away from the bad. So I used the traffic example earlier. If you've ever gotten in the car and you've driven to a place you've been 1,000 times only to arrive and thought to yourself, wow, I don't even actually remember the ride over here. That's kind of an example that's really common that most of us can relate to of mindlessness. We go through our day and we encounter the same things. We would say that we do the same things as well. But everything that we do in our day, we can apply mindfulness to. And mindfulness is just a simple reminder of keying into the present moment and doing things intentionally. And what's great about mindfulness is that sometimes the most important practice comes around doing the things that we do most often. I like to think of, I always make time for coffee in the morning. So when I'm making coffee, if I can start my day really keen into the experience of making the coffee, smelling the grounds, watching it brew, smelling it, the aroma filling the room, and then being able to sit down with that cup of coffee and really just focus in on the experience of having that cup of coffee. Of course, many would say that that cup of coffee was much better than just the normal racing through the morning, get that coffee, get out the door, and get into your day. So mindfulness and mindlessness are something that we are going to constantly be talking about in the ACT process.
So Jeff, what are the goals of ACT?
The goal ultimately is something called psychological flexibility. Now that's a very clinical term, but to think of psychological flexibility, we might relate to a scenario where if I'm out with friends and we all are sitting around dinner and the waitress brings water, and as she's setting the water on the table, I dump mine over. Now, if I'm really psychologically rigid, I might feel really upset at myself, really condemning myself, or have a lot of negative self-talk. Or if I'm being flexible, I might realize that it happens, that mistakes happen, that it's just water, that it's something that can be cleaned up. Yes, it's embarrassing. I felt embarrassed. I wish that wouldn't have happened. But ultimately, it's things that happen. And so the goal of ACT is just that, is to promote flexibility in the way that we think, flexibility in the way that we see things. Now, which is pretty common with a lot of other interventions and different therapies. ACT uses mindfulness and practices mindfulness as a way of achieving psychological flexibility or flexibility in the way that we think. Now, one of the goals, of course, is to address the common experience or the human experience trying to avoid the things that are uncomfortable. So as I mentioned earlier, one of the avenues that we will take is confronting the agenda. And this is probably one of the first things that we are going to address. As we mentioned earlier, clients are likely to come in with the agenda of eliminating all the bad, uncomfortable, distressing things about their experience as a way of finally being able to achieve pursuing a meaningful life. So the client's agenda of emotional control is gently and respectfully undermined as we realize that the constant avoidance of these internal processes, these constant avoidance of thoughts and feelings, is actually what's creating a lot of the pain and suffering in the client's experience. So as we confront the agenda of trying to eliminate or avoid these experiences by building acceptance at the same time that these experiences are inherent, they're natural, and they don't have to have any control over what we pursue in our lives. So, for example, to give a little bit more context to this particular concept, avoiding going to work because of possibly having to meet with the boss, or avoiding job interviews because of possible rejection, avoiding leaving a relationship in fear of being alone, or avoiding relationships in fear of abandonment. These are examples of how I'm trying to control certain emotional experiences that are inherent with pursuing those goals, like having a job, being promoted within that job, having relationships. These are inherent experiences. So once we've confronted that agenda and we build acceptance that there are inherent discomforts in pursuit of these valuable goals, then we really work hard to define values. Now, earlier, I mentioned goals and values. Now, goals, which is pretty common in most therapeutic settings, we want to achieve a certain place or position that indicates that we have arrived at progress or we have arrived at a certain milestone. And goals are thought of as something we arrive at, where values are something that are with us all the time. We're working with them all the time. I like to think that goals are a destination and values are like signs along the way, or maybe even more specifically, values can be thought of as our compass. So while a goal might be to run a marathon or to achieve a lower blood pressure, a value might be wellness. So as wellness as a value informs the direction I take and the choices I make through my day-to-day.
What does that look like in session? How do you get to being able to identify client values and being able to bring that up in therapy?
Well, oftentimes clients are very aware of what goals are important to them. They usually come in with some concept. Now, while it's important that we're as specific as possible and we're measurable, so we start with that process. And then in terms of commitment, as I mentioned earlier, understanding what challenges are inherent with achieving those goals, and then applying or identifying what values are going to be useful in achieving those goals. So, as I mentioned earlier, as commitment is, it's easy for me to commit to a goal like running a marathon. But truly, what I'm committing to is valuing the hard work, the discipline, the wellness that it takes to achieve that goal, as I'm going to have to get up every day and work in a running schedule, take care of my body, hydrate it, fuel it the correct way, so ultimately, in the months later, I can finally run that marathon.
So when you have a client that comes in, you ask them what their goal is, and they might say, well, I want to run a marathon here in the next 4 months or whatever it is. And then as a clinician, you reflect that back, that you have a value of wellness.
Yes. So we would work hard as in this stage of the earlier stages of ACT therapy to identify how those goals and those values are connected.
If it's a goal of running a marathon, but your value is wellness, there's other ways to meet that value of wellness, so that if, you know, God forbid they hurt their knee or something and can't run the marathon, they can still meet their value of wellness in other ways.
Right. And we would invite all the behaviors that would be consistent with that value, what we consider to be value-directed action, part of that choosing or actively choosing a valuable direction, which may include doing other things that are good for our health. So we would spend a great deal of time. There are lots of activities and exercises that are introduced early on after we have talked about the agenda and talked about goals to clarify values, because values are going to be our pathway. Values are going to be sort of the path that we build together in session that allows someone to move towards what they consider to be a quality life. What I like most about ACT is that it asks the question, how willing are we to accept the discomforts, the challenges inherent with going towards what we consider to be a valuable life, even amidst the challenges and stressors and discomforts? Again, everything works from this stance that we're going to constantly confront this issue of trying to avoid that which is distressing or uncomfortable, that by avoiding these things, it actually might be preventing us from living a quality life. So we promote the idea that we're actively choosing, and somehow in this process, we are getting caught up in our words and needing to start over. In the process of talking about our values and creating that pathway with our clients, we show our clients that they can choose, actively choose, and commit to going towards what they consider to be valuable, making valuable actions, living in those values, being consistent with those values, that actually allows them to arrive at their goals, again, is more of a side effect of valuing day to day, even amidst all those challenges and those discomforts and stressors that are inherent, but not only just being human, being alive, but also pursuing that which is meaningful.
As part of being a behavioral therapy, I imagine there's this whole process of developing a hierarchy, letting them to slowly confront some of these things that they've been avoiding as opposed to telling them to jump in the deep end of the pool. It's all a part of that process.
Right. We understand that this is a huge paradigm shift. For most people, they, again, come to counseling with the agenda of eliminating these barriers. What we're asking is for clients to radically accept that those experiences are there and to make approximations towards moving around, moving over, moving through these perceived barriers, that with every step, and it's important, like with any goal setting or goal work, that we take small steps, that actually the confidence and acceptance is building through that process of moving in a valuable direction. We believe, as ACT clinicians, that going in this valuable direction is actually what gives life meaning. Again, that is, it's not necessarily the goal, which again might be what the client has in mind, that if I could just simply be healthier, then I would start working out again, or if I had more confidence, I would finally ask for that promotion. But if I were able to make small steps and do things that are consistent with these goals and these values, then I might actually find that the quality of life improves, even amidst fears, doubts, hesitations, stressors, all of the above.
So one thing you said a minute ago, I think it's an important point. So a lot of times clients will think that I need to get rid of this feeling first before I can take the action, as opposed to you can take the action and still experience the feeling. If I was more confident, I could go to the gym. And instead you say you need to take these small steps of going to the gym and eventually you'll feel more confident.
There's a great book called The Confidence Gap where Russ Harris talks about the trouble. One of the points he makes is that the trouble with confidence is that if we expect ourselves to be confident before we've tried something new or tried something different, then we may never get to it. And oftentimes that's our experience, and many people can relate to that experience. What he likes to point out is that if we want to build confidence, then confidence comes from the act of doing. And if I like to use public speaking, as a good example. Most of us weren't born feeling confident publicly speaking. But the more that I speak publicly, the more confidence I will feel. Now, you may not feel total confidence even after several trainings and opportunities to speak publicly. I still experience a bit of nervousness, a bit of tension, a bit of doubt and judgment. But with practice, I build acceptance of the presence of those things, knowing that that is just an inherent part of the process, an inherent part of the experience. It doesn't have to deter me away from actively doing what matters most, and that's, of course, doing things like podcasts and live trainings and even trainings and teachings that I do on the campus.
I think that's a great point. And so looking at in session, you have the clients that come in, that identify their goal. You reflect back that this is meeting this higher value for you and helping them to acknowledge that and to know that they're trying to move in those directions of those values. What are some of the other things that come up in a typical ACT session?
Well, obviously, one of the things that we're going to encounter is just the typical experience feeling fused with that internal dialogue. ACT, which is rooted in contextual functionalism and relational framework theory, which are two very important theories to understand in terms of ACT. But the good news is we don't have to understand those, per se, to understand ACT. But the way that we use language internally is oftentimes one of the biggest issues that we will confront with our clients in sessions, because that internal voice can either be a coach or it can be a hindrance. Sometimes we have really negative internal processes and we apply our internal language to certain experiences that might deter us away from doing things that are valuable. As we mentioned earlier, it's perfectly natural to understand why we as humans try to avoid discomfort. We try to avoid stressors. You know, if it was a burning building, it's perfectly natural for us wanting to escape. Perfectly understandable that we would want to run away. But if it was a fear, if it was a negative self-talk, if it was a negative judgment internally that we're confronting, I might avoid that by avoiding pursuing what's meaningful. Because as I mentioned earlier, like with public speaking, I'm going to encounter some nervous feelings, I'm going to encounter some judgments, and internally I might be having thoughts like, you know, if I was only as charismatic as Russ Harris, or if I was only as direct as Kurt Strassel, some of the big names in ACT, then I would be an effective ACT clinician. But what ACT tries to focus on, again, is returning someone back to their understanding, their conscious awareness of what matters most to them. So even amidst having those internal dialogues, those internal experiences, sometimes that internal voice will trip us up and complicate our motivation or drive towards things that are meaningful.
ACT is basically saying that just because I have this internal dialogue, these internal voices, doesn't mean I necessarily have to buy into what they're telling me.
Right. And in its essence, ACT, again, continues to point out that our thoughts and our feelings are just thoughts and feelings that we experience. They're just internal collection of words, images, scenarios. It's our imagination being playful. It's our mind being playful. That we create that distance from our thoughts and feelings, that even though they're running, then our mind will constantly run. If you've ever, as I mentioned earlier, if you've ever sat down to meditate or if you're new to meditation, you're familiar with this constant rolling of thoughts, judgments, and emotions, that continue to play, and I can still, with mindfulness, with my observer self, pursue what's meaningful. So it's not eliminating that thought. It's not trying to completely get rid of these inherent experiences. It's doing it even amidst it.
And when you say it's not eliminating that thought, and that's one of the things that makes it different from maybe some of the other cognitive behavior therapies, is it's not this idea of I'm having this thought, so I need to challenge it and get rid of it completely. It's just accepting I have this thought, but I can still do those things that are important for my values anyway.
Absolutely. And what's important to recognize is that, like with meditation, most people's idea of mindfulness meditation is to sit with an empty mind, to sit with no thoughts and be completely tranquil. Well, I haven't, in all my years of practicing meditation, have never experienced actually sitting down and having no thoughts or no mind. Mind's chatter or mind's playfulness is constantly rolling. So if I have the goal of meditating or being mindful with no thoughts, that internal voice may tell me, oh, you're doing it wrong. You're never going to achieve mindfulness. You just don't understand this concept. It's too hard. You should try something else. And these are all feedback that I get oftentimes with people who are starting mindfulness or starting the ACT process. That voice is just so amplified that I cannot even pursue the things that are meaningful. I can't go the direction, or I can't, in other words, just continue the practice. So if we focus solely on that experience, that internal dialogue, that mindless chatter that's going on all the time, then my focus becomes the barrier. And like mindfulness, as we mentioned earlier, it's about using contact with the present moment to shift focus onto what I can do, what I can actively choose, what matters most, what feels more valuable, even while that's going. Usually if I can focus my energy towards meditating anyway, or sitting and listening to my breath anyway, or making a public speech anyway, even though those thoughts, those feelings occur, then I might find that that's actually more gratifying. That's what feels more valuable. So usually after we define the values and we've really understood what matters most to a client, we use that question, or I will use that question often. Well, what matters most now? What feels most important now? Even amidst these discomforts, even amidst these stressors, I use that question of what feels most valuable now as a way of bringing a client's focus back onto the valued path, or the path of their values, their valued direction. What's the most important thing that we do now? What feels more valuable to you? And shifting that focus, kind of constantly coming back to that question of what matters most, allows the client to resolve their focus on the barriers, resolve their focus on the internal stressors, that internal dialogue, and more so on what can I actively choose to do now.
I think that's very empowering for them whenever you keep coming back to you're experiencing depression, you're experiencing anxiety, you're wanting to avoid these situations, but what are your values? And what are those actions that you can take to move you toward those values?
Right. What we find from that process, which is so amazing, is that not only is it a constant act of building acceptance, building awareness, making contact with these things, because we're not trying to eliminate them. We're saying that they can exist, but I don't have to focus on them. They don't have to become my whole experience. In fact, that cognitive diffusion part says that this part isn't my whole experience, that these are just thoughts and images, these are judgments, these are predictions that are typically false or amplified. I have something of a different experience as an observer. So we work with things like diffusion and making contact with the present moment, of course, which require that mindfulness piece to constantly shift our focus away from the internal process to the active process of valuing. So how does this look in session? More specifically, what does an ACT experience look like? Again, a client is often going to present with a goal of erasing the pain or discomfort associated with what they consider to be living a valuable life. So we confront that issue of trying to avoid. We address the futility of constantly trying to avoid the discomfort while pursuing something meaningful. And actually that avoidance piece is actually what's preventing us from living their life. And then we identify the values, which is the next part. And we understand, of course, in terms of defining the values, what we would want to understand is strategies that haven't worked. For example, I might avoid feeling anxious by using substances only to find that my discomfort or my anxiety continues to grow, which amplifies my urges or needs for these substances. So we examine that while I'm trying to escape the discomfort, that actually trying to avoid the discomfort is what's amplifying my urges and my suffering. So we examine those strategies that haven't worked. we establish control with something different strategies for pursuing what's meaningful, and we identify those values that are inherent with that path, with going towards those goals. Of course, we want to define the values as a way of building meaning towards doing something differently. Oftentimes, we're very aware, or clients are very aware, of strategies that haven't worked in trying to eliminate or avoid their discomfort. That's our initial stage. And then we return to something called the hexaflex. And the hexaflex is kind of a cool term for a model that defines six core therapeutic processes in ACT. As I mentioned, some of the pieces that require mindfulness, of course, contacting the present moment, cognitive diffusion, acceptance, selfish context, values, and committed action. Now, some of these I've explained, but I'm going to walk us through kind of what each one of these mean so everyone can understand how the hexaflex really does structure and bring focus to any ACT work. So the first one, contacting the present moment, is just that, making contact with what's present, not just in our external world, but also psychologically present, what kind of thoughts, what kind of feelings, what kind of sensations we're having. The opposite of contacting the present moment might be thought of as autopilot, where we're just kind of going about our day. We're not really registering or tuning into what's going on, particularly inside of us. So that's contacting the present moment, which is obviously key in making active decisions towards valued means. Diffusion is the other part. Now, diffusion is a cool part of this because there's a lot of exercises that come out of cognitive diffusion. Diffusion is, in other words, that distancing from our thoughts and feelings. It takes the stance that diffusion is separating ourselves, who we are, from our thoughts and our feelings, as we are not our thoughts and our feelings. We experience thoughts and feelings, but they are not us. And we're going to talk about that in terms of self as context. But I like to think of diffusion kind of like our normal thought processes. We would normally be caught up in our thoughts. Diffusion is much like stepping off the stage that is the production of our thoughts or the drama of our thinking and sitting front row and watching this production play out. I'm not trying to stop the play. I'm not trying to halt all the drama going on stage, but I am sitting front row fully aware that I'm watching a production. I am something separate from my thoughts and feelings. So that, of course, again, requires a great deal of mindfulness and mindfulness practice. The next part, as we've talked about, is acceptance. And I like to think of acceptance, again, as kind of a willingness to make contact with whatever comes up. And that includes what happens internally, any thoughts, any feelings, any judgments, any sensations that might occur. Now, acceptance can also be thought of as something that we utilize or we practice externally, of course, too, as there are a great deal of circumstances that we cannot control. As I mentioned that example earlier with traffic, that traffic is not something I can control. So acceptance is something that I can apply, a willingness to sit in traffic without letting it destroy my comfort or destroy what I perceive to be meaningful or cause me to get lost in the web of thoughts that might be created from that discomfort. Now, self as context is really important. In terms of diffusion, we're very familiar, we've been talking about, with our thinking self, the part that's constantly rolling, the part that's constantly generating thoughts, beliefs, memories, judgments, categorizations, comparisons, and so on. That's that constant film rolling in the background. But most of us aren't as familiar with the observing self. This is something that we achieve with mindfulness, the aspect of us that is aware that we're thinking, that we're feeling. If I were to ask you, Micah, to go back to what you did this morning for breakfast, if I asked you to imagine what you did when you got up, whatever process you had, getting ready in the morning, having breakfast, getting in the car and driving here, you are aware that you're having these memories and walking through this process, you're not your memories. You're not your thoughts. You're not these images that are occurring in your mind of what you did this morning. You are the observer. So we like to think of ourselves as context. The self as context is being able to achieve the person or make contact with the self that transcends our experiences or transcends these thoughts and feelings or these judgments. Another example of self as context is if I, to use kind of the opposite, self as concept or the conceptualized self, if I conceptualize myself as an effective clinician, well, I conceptualize self might become troublesome whenever I forget to do something or I don't have a session that feels as connected, or I forget to contact a client back, or I do something that is inconsistent with this conceptualized self. So it's important to realize that concept of an amazing clinician or effective clinician can be destructive, as I'm not always that role. I may not always be that conceptualized image. And so we use self as context to realize that we are something more than our experience. We are something more than a collection of our memories, our thoughts, and our feelings. And then we move on as to one of the other cornerstones of ACT. Now, the other piece, of course, is values, values clarification. So this part of the Hexaflex, I enjoy approaching with a client by asking certain questions like, what do you want your life to be about? What do you want your friends and family to say about you at the end of your life? And these are important questions, as ACT is considered sort of an existential philosophy. We ask the question, what matters most in the big picture? One of the exercises that I like to utilize with a client in terms of values clarification is imagine that you've worked in your career for many years and you've arrived at the end of your career and you're about to retire, and all your coworkers, your friends, your family, everybody that you have worked with, your mentors, have all gathered together, and each one of them are going to make a speech about you and their experience with you across your life. What are some of the things you want them to say? Now, most of the time, what we get from this conversation is some really good discussions about what we value most, or what we would want our life to be about, or what we would want our work to symbolize, or what kind of impact we would want to have on other people's lives, what kind of impact we would want to have in the world. ACT is considered an existential therapy. We are asking, what's the most important thing that we want to take from our life? So as I mentioned earlier, it's asking the client to consider what matters most, either in the moment when facing a barrier, when facing some discomfort, or the larger picture. What do you want your life to be about? What do you want people to look back on and say that you symbolize the most? So the most important thing to know about values is that they're qualities of ongoing action that define what we consider to be a meaningful life. So clarifying these values is essential to the ACT model, as they provide a compass for all action taken by the client. Now, the last piece is perhaps, again, another cornerstone piece that we touched on in our discussion today. It is committed action. Without all this, without committed action, we would just be identifying values. We would just be building mindfulness skills. We'd just be aware of things. Committed action is the second part of acceptance commitment, and that's taking meaningful, effective action guided by the values that we clarified earlier in stages of therapy. And the values-guided action is a matter of doing what it takes to live a meaningful life, even amidst discomfort, pain, stresses, challenges that are inherent or along the path. Again, returning to the idea that these things can exist, I can diffuse from them both internally and externally by building acceptance, building mindfulness, observing them along the way, and then using my values to guide my path, guide my action, guide my decisions and my choices that promotes what I consider to be a valuable life.
Jeff, will you go through and list the different parts of the Hexaflex that you just described?
Absolutely. So the six core therapeutic processes in the Hexaflex are contacting the present moment, cognitive diffusion, acceptance, self as context, values, and committed action.
And even though there's certainly distinctive features about ACT that separate it from other therapies, those concepts are concepts that could almost use with any type of therapeutic approach.
You're absolutely right. And that's what I like about third wave therapies. They do capture sort of an eclectic picture of a lot of therapies. But these six processes could be thought of as something that, again, like most therapies, arrive at the goal of creating a meaningful life. The unique characteristic is that we're not focused on symptoms or symptom elimination. What we find is that through building mindfulness, building acceptance, understanding values, and pursuing committed action, that symptom reduction happens as a side effect.
Jeff, are there any particular books or websites that you would recommend to people if therapists wanted to learn more about ACT?
There's some of them that are really, really good, but they may be a bit clinical. Of course, Stephen Hayes, Kurt Strassel, and Kelly Wilson have written manuals for clinicians, for adolescents, for adults. They have beginning ACT manuals. They have advanced ACT manuals. And those are great foundational pieces or works to study. Perhaps one of my greatest influences has been Russ Harris, who is an ACT clinician and author. And one of his books that I absolutely love and I return to often is ACT Made Simple. And what I hope is that while ACT may seem really comprehensive and expansive and in a lot of ways complex, Russ does a great job of simplifying the ACT model and providing useful metaphors and examples that we can all relate to, whether you're a clinician or not. And Russ actually has a website as well, actmindfully.com.au, as Russ is out of Australia. And those are some resources that I like to offer to clients as well, particularly as encouraging clients to become familiar with the ACT model. I always want people to do their own research in their own time. But ACT Made Simple and actmindfully.com.au are great resources for anybody. And then, of course, like I said, the ACT manuals written by Hayes, Strassel, and Wilson are great for clinicians to capture more of a comprehensive clinical picture of what the ACT model offers.
And there's also some YouTube videos that have come out of Australia that help teach some ACT concepts.
There are some really great videos and videos that I actually utilize in session a lot. Russ has created, through the actmindfully.com.au website, as well as YouTube, you can find a list of his videos that define some of the core concepts that we talked about today. And he explains them through very, very powerful metaphors, which are, again, something characteristic to the ACT model. But he provides simple explanations using simple examples and metaphors that we can relate to in the therapeutic process that best explain how to utilize some of these concepts in session.
And I love the videos. They have the Australian narrator and kind of cheesy animation, but they are really powerful. I've used them in session before. I like the passengers on the bus. A lot of clients like that video.
The passengers on the bus is really a great one as it talks about committed action and values clarification and really all the other six core processes. And of course, these are so well explained by Russ Harris as he has that very enjoyable Australian accent that's very enjoyable to listen to. And oftentimes clients find more enjoyable than my voice, but they're very easy to understand videos and examples.
Well, Jeff, thank you so much for talking to us about ACT today, and you're going to be doing some workshops for us. You're going to be doing an ACT with substance abuse, is that correct?
I am. I'm really excited about being able to utilize ACT and share ACT from a particular perspective when it comes to substance abuse and recovery. So I'm excited to announce those dates coming soon, and hope to have everyone there live and in person so we can understand ACT in the treatment of substance abuse disorders.
Jeff, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate you letting us know about ACT.
Thank you so much, Micah. Thank you for having me, and thank you for everyone listening.
Thank you for listening to CEU Cast. We hope you found this content valuable for supporting your professional development. The views of our guests are his or hers alone and are not necessarily shared by the owners of CEU Cast. If you'd like to earn continuing education credit for this program, go to ceucast.com now.